Hello, and welcome to the College Crosscast, a lacrosse news, analysis, and commentary podcast. My name is Saif Fakadu, and I'm your host for today's show. On the other line with me is special guest Zach Capozzi, founder of lacrosse analytics site Lacrosse Reference. Zach, thanks so much for making the time to come on the pod today. How are you doing?
Absolutely. This is listened to you guys for a long time, so this is exciting.
Definitely appreciate the kind words, and as listeners and people follow us on Twitter know, huge fan of Zach's work. I think Lacrosse Reference is one of the most accessible, user-friendly, lax data sites out there, and definitely fill the need, and happy to have you on the show. What we always like to do with guests is kind of, you know, get to know them before we get into the nitty-gritty about the game. So obviously love to, you know, hear like where you grew up, and did you like play lacrosse as a child or in high school?
So I grew up in Catonsville, Maryland. So we had UMBC right down the road. My lacrosse playing career is sort of one of my big regrets in life. I actually played baseball growing up. This was the Cal Ripken years and all that. So it was kind of top of mind. But I grew up in Baltimore. So of course I had a stick. I knew how to play. I had cousins that played. So I didn't really actually start playing lacrosse seriously until college, played on the dorm team and all that stuff. And then when I'd be home for the summers, I played in the kind of the adult leagues in Baltimore, Anne Arundel Community College and all that. So I've watched lacrosse my whole life. I would say my playing career is probably on the short end, but I remember scoring a goal in a game in a Heroes League against a defender who had a helmet that said Delaware. So that was the highlight. That's the highlight of my lacrosse career.
Hey, while some other lacrosse fans, kind of diss baseball growing up, baseball was, meat and potatoes for kids. So, well, what position were you on the diamond?
I played shortstop. So I was like the Ray Ordonez of Catonsville baseball. Couldn't hit that well, but like a vacuum cleaner with the glove.
Definitely. I bet a good on base percentage too. Good eye at the
play. Yeah, I was a good bunter. That was my one skill.
Right on. And I think from previous pod, I believe you went to Notre Dame for college. Is that right? Or did you get a big fan of the Irish? Yeah. Were you there for that, that early 2010s, like dominant years, when they were Final Four repeatedly, or like right before or after?
No, I had graduated before that, a couple years before that. But I did. We were lucky enough to go to be in the final at the Final Four for that gut-wrenching game against Duke, where Costabile scored off the draw in overtime. So, even before that, though. I mean, it was a fun time to be at Notre Dame because everybody cares about football there, and basketball was really good when I was there. But like you could just stroll into the lacrosse games and like sit right next to the field, and so it was fun. I mean, not a lot of people went to those, relatively compared to the other sports, but they had good T-shirt deals, so I went as much as I could.
Oh, of course, and their prominence in the game has grown significantly. Like it's Corrigan's definitely be commended, but them, Maryland, Duke, and Denver were definitely running college lacrosse for, a little over a decade. So, you're exactly right. We always have fun with the Irish. I'm a big fan, a little bit more than some of my compatriots. But I always, liken lacrosse to football. Once Notre Dame and Michigan got into football, it really exploded. Obviously, times have changed with technology and makes it more accessible for people. But anchor institutions like Notre Dame being good in lacrosse is good, great for the game.
Absolutely. Nice big Subway alumni, especially in New York. I mean, that was the thing that you always realize with football is that like there's such a huge Notre Dame fan base in the New York area. And so I think it translates really well for them to be good at lacrosse because you already have that sort of a good core fan base in, one of the lacrosse hotbed areas.
Oh, of course. I mean, big Northeast elite. So I'm a big fan. Yeah, I love that. Old school Regis clips. He was always huge Irish guy. So definitely a huge presence in the Northeast. And after college, professional years, like before Lacrosse Reference, so like just a fan or on the message boards, like everybody or any like Max Power memories and stuff,
You know, honestly, I really wasn't too much. I mean, you know, sports is such a social thing, and you know, I really didn't have a lot of friends. I lived in Chicago after school for 10 years, and pretty limited amount of like. I mean, Chicago's a college sports town, but it's football and to a small degree basketball. So like, there just weren't a lot of people watching lacrosse, and so to me, like, if I wasn't watching it with my friends. Out of sight, out of mind. So I was never really to a message board person. You know, it was until much later that you know, sort of, I kind of really got into, like, thought about, hey, you know, maybe I could do this as a real thing. But for me, it was, you know, it was, I would watch the Final Four by myself mostly. But that was kind of like, once lacrosse season was over, we'd roll right into baseball, and you know, that was that.
No, you're right, Zach. The kids today don't know the struggle. Of the aughts. You had to one game a week on ESPNU. Maybe you can hear a radio broadcast, essentially just filing the live stats.
Absolutely.
You used to watch our games uphill both ways back in the day. So, yeah, there's a great transition into, I want to talk about like the origins of lacrosse reference. So, obviously, you know, fan of the sport, kind of read about the about section, kind of recognize there's a lack of, lacrosse analytics things. So I'd like to share, like, you know, just the idea of lacrosse reference, how it came about, and, you know, we'll get to a little bit other details further.
Yeah, absolutely. So we lived in Chicago. I live with a bunch of Notre Dame friends, and I think it was, you know, it's 2014 or 2015. I can't remember which year it was, but Notre Dame was in the Final Four. You know, they were playing Denver, and I remember because they were down like 4 goals with like 3 minutes left. And so, you know, there's a timeout or something. And so my first thought was like, okay, you know, they have win probabilities for other sports. I wonder what, you know, Notre Dame's win probability is right now. Like, what's the chance that they're going to, that they can come back? Mm. So, you know, we're sitting there and Googling around and, you know, obviously couldn't find it, right? No one had a win probability for lacrosse. And, you know, so being at the bar and having great ideas, we, you know, that was like the day we booked lacrossereference.com. And it was just sort of like, look, if this doesn't exist, for lacrosse, you know, it's something that I always enjoyed, you know, keeping an eye on watching other sports. It's like, well, you know, I could probably do that. Let's get the website and see where this goes. So that was kind of the kernel of the idea. I mean, obviously we didn't do anything with it because, you know, we had other things occupying our attention at the time, but that was sort of where the initial idea came from. And then, you know, you kind of sat there for a couple of years before I actually had the motivation to do it. But, you know, I think in general, right, I've always been enthralled with the stats and following a team is as much about, like, you know, keeping an eye on how they're doing as it is watching the games and talking about the games. And, you know, as I watched lacrosse, it was like, well, this part's missing. So maybe someone should build it. And why couldn't that someone be me? So that's kind of how it started. And obviously it's kind of, you know, expanded and evolved a bit since that initial idea, but that's really where it came from.
Oh, I love that story. Real social network energy there. Gotta get a screen for the Fincher. As you mentioned 2015, I know that season very well. That was Hopkins. I was at the game at the Link. That's Hopkins. It was great. I was living in Philly. First year I was writing for the site, I was just like kind of unpaid contributor, but it was a great year for Hop fans. So you kind of like got the idea of essentially the origins of it there, but like how did it kind of develop into, you know, not to what it is now, but like, you know, the initial steps after the first idea came about?
Yeah, man, it was the definition of a slog. What happened was, we had our first kid in 2016. And so I'm like on paternity leave from work. And you know, that was actually the time that I was like, okay, well, you know what? It was right around the Final Four in 2016 that he was born. So, you know, lacrosse was top of mind. I had some time, you know, and so, you know, that was when I really said, okay, let's try and do this. Let's do it. So what I started with was, okay, well, hey, why don't we build that win probability model? Like, that shouldn't be too hard. But then you're like, okay, well, if we're going to do that, we need some data to build a model off of. And so then it's like, okay, well, how can we go ahead and find some data? It's like, okay, well, all these teams have like play-by-play logs from past games for past years. So, you know, then it was like a weeks long, probably months long effort of just like trying to go through and scrape all this like play-by-play data off of these various websites. And at the time, I'm ashamed to admit, I did not realize the NCAA had like a full site of all these things in a standardized form. So I'm like going through like various teams have all these different like providers and different formats and all that stuff. So long story short, like over a couple of months, I kind of got all this play-by-play data and cleaned it up and kind of got it in a standardized form, and then just kind of started creating that win probability model. And so it was, you know, it did take quite longer than I thought it was going to take. But once I had it, it was kind of like, okay, well, now we can start to do this. And I remember kind of posting a first like article on the site. Shout out to Jesse McNulty, who was like an analyst with the Atlanta Blaze at the time. And, you know, I was just basically like, hey, Jesse, I made this. And he was gracious enough to kind of retweet it out and kind of engage a little bit with the idea. And, you know, at that point, it was like, you know, if 10 people saw something that I posted, it was like a great day. And so those early ones were pretty rough, pretty raw and pretty ugly. But, you know, at that point, like there's such a big difference between like having one article up on a site and like not having a site. So it was ugly, but it was kind of that watershed.
No, of course. And you know what? Please forgive my ignorance, but like you're describing like coming up with the model. Could you give like a little insight? Like is it just the mathematical formula? Like, again, I plead ignorance on this, and I hope I don't embarrass myself too much, but I'd love to know a little insight on like, yeah, how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, with all this stuff, there's sort of the kernel. Everybody can kind of sense what a win probability model does, right? I mean, everyone has a gut sense of it. You know, if you're up six with 1 minute left, you're probably going to win. If you're down six, you're probably going to lose. You know, if it's tied at halftime and one team is better than the other, they probably are still going to have a plus 50 win probability. So, I mean, the math of it is fairly straightforward. It's basically, you know, if we know what the chance is that a team wins a game going into it, right? You know, let's say one team A has an 80% chance to win. Then, you know, when at the draw, right, their win probability is going to be 80% at the opening draw. But then as the game goes along, right, we care less about what we thought was going to happen before the game, and we care more about kind of time and score. So, you know, step one was just go through and say, okay, at every point throughout a 60-minute game and for every possible, you know, lead, what has happened historically, right? So how often does a team with a 6-goal lead and 1 minute left win the game? I mean, 100%. How often does a team with a 1-goal lead at halftime win the game? You know, it's probably closer to like 60%. So we essentially end up with those two numbers, right? What was the chance coming into the game, which sort of reflects how good the two teams are? And then what's the time and score? And so then we kind of, you know, make the weight given to the time and score number go up as the game goes along, and the weight given to the, you know, team strength number go down as the game goes along. And essentially you just kind of say, well, where are we in the game? Use that weighting, put the two numbers together, and that's your win probability.
Oh, thank you. And like, you know, so after like a weekend, like putting all the data together, you have all, you know, all this information, just, you know, I'm impressed with like how you're able to compile it, put it out there, like how, you know, the process of just, you know, compiling all that and presenting it to the public and stuff. Like,
yeah.
How long?
Yeah, I mean, it's so there's kind of like, you know, anytime you're talking about data, cleanliness and structure and standardization is like key, right? So that's step one, and probably 80% of the effort is just going from those live play-by-play logs to, you know, a standardized set of events, right? So that's kind of step one. So, you know, they say, okay, face off TD Ireland versus blah, 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 you know, won by Yale or, you know, won by Denver in the future. So that kind of gets parsed by a natural language processing algorithm that I wrote. And so you go from that sentence to an event that says player one, TD Ireland, player two, somebody else, event, face off, one, you know, team, Yale. So, you know, all the play-by-play gets converted into those individual events. And then from there, it's just a kind of a straightforward process of rolling them up, right? So I said, okay, well, of those events, 10 were shots. So put 10 shots into the events or 10 events into the shots database. We have a player who we've never seen before, put them into the players database. So, you know, once you have that play-by-play and you've got it sort of converted into a set of discrete events, then it's just a process of rolling all that stuff up. In some cases, we'll do calculations, right? So an individual shot also has an expected shooting percentage based on various factors. So, you know, that kind of gets added to that shots table. And then you can add up things like, okay, well, now I have a player and I have a set of shots, each with an expected win or expected shot percentage. So by adding up all those things for each player, now I have, you know, what's their excess shooting percentage and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's sort of step one is just get it into that standardized events database. And then, you know, it's like a whole horde of scripts that run through that stuff and do all kinds of calculations and summaries and aggregations. And at the end of the day, you end up with a team and a player and a site and all the stuff is updated. So it's mostly automated. It's just, you know, it's always tough when you're dealing with live stats because you'll kind of have all kinds of strange things that get entered and timestamps will be screwed up. So most of the effort at this point is just making sure that the data is clean. And once it's clean, it just kind of goes through the meat grinder and, you know, out pops lacrosse reference.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a big fan of just like simple, just clean look of lacrosse pro. And full disclosure, listeners, Zach was gracious enough to provide the essentially team account for us to preview before the show. So I just want to definitely pay my compliments to you and any other team members you have, just how you put everything out there in such a user-friendly way. Sorry to just hammer on this lax data stuff. It's just so interesting for me.
Yeah.
Before we move on, just quickly, any similarities you find between like lax data and like other sports? I enjoy your glossary and how you've sometimes compare what you're doing with like other sports for people who are more familiar with like baseball war or other type of like.
I mean, it's interesting. And I think, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, I think a lot of it depends on what you're trying to do, right? So, yeah, I mean, that, you know, if your goal is to try and aggregate players' contributions into a single number, I mean, I think the comparison war in baseball is a really good one. Because, you know, at the end of the day, war is just a set of discrete events and each of them is given a value. You add it up and that's the player's, you know, final war value. And we're doing the same thing with the EGA expected goals model that I have for lacrosse. So I think from that perspective, I think baseball is a good comparison because people are pretty familiar with war at this point. You know, the PER number in basketball is kind of the same thing. So, you know, I think if you're looking at kind of like individual players, there's definitely a similarity there. I think if you think about like kind of the tactical stuff, right? So, you know, if you want to use lacrosse data to create some insights that might help coach differently, I mean, that's, I think, a lot tougher because like baseball is, everything is discrete, right? There's a pitch, there's one batter and one pitcher and maybe one fielder, maybe two fielders that get involved. You know, lacrosse is a lot more like hockey or basketball in that like you don't really have those sort of like individual discrete events where like most of the people aren't doing anything. So from that perspective, it's a lot more challenging because like in basketball, they've got all the stadiums rigged up with those sport view cameras. So like they are able to get to like who was the closest defender. You know, how fast was the guy running, that sort of stuff. Like in lacrosse, we don't even know who's on the field 90% of the time from the play-by-play information. So like, you know, that I think there's a similarity with basketball and maybe even now what they're starting to do with football, and that like any event in lacrosse, all of the players are interacting, you know, in such a way that it's much more like unit versus unit than individual players. So that makes it much more difficult to do things that are kind of like tactically relevant in lacrosse right now. Because, you know, it's not the same sort of like clean data environment like you have in baseball, which, you know, I think in one sense is fine, because like I would love to see, and I think we will see eventually, a world where like there are cameras rigged up watching every player, and we have information on who has the ball and where the closest defender was. Like, I think we'll get there. But I think in that sense, like, lacrosse is way behind some of those other kind of more free flowing sports, because there just hasn't been as much of an investment in kind of getting beyond the box score, if you will.
Definitely. And, you know, big fan of obviously lacrosse reference handle. How have you found the, you know, the engagement with the fans that helped develop the site? Sure, a lot of people share compliments, and sure, like, it's kind of like a great resource for teams and stuff like that. I'm sure they have their own data, stuff like that, but it's just right there. And just wondering, yeah, like, you know, engaging with the public and their response to the site. How have you found that?
I mean, honestly, it's like mostly radio silence. Honestly, I really don't get too many people commenting or giving feedback or like telling me I'm an idiot. And not that I want that specifically, but like, you know, I would love it if I got more emails from people saying like, hey, you know, why is this way? Or how'd you calculate this? Or, you know, you're an idiot because you think Hopkins is bad, you know, whatever the thing is. Like, you know, that was one of the funny things when the pandemic started. Like you said, like, coaches follow the site, and I know I've got like Twitter followers that are coaches. And so, you know, I started reaching out to them and just like, hey, you know, kind of sorry your season was kind of cut off short there. Like, hope things are well. Hope everybody's safe and all that. Just kind of saying hi, because I know that was as much of a bummer as it was for us as fans. I'm sure it was 10 times worse for the coaches and players. So, but, it, you know, it was funny. That was when I really realized like kind of how much they are using it, because a lot of them were saying, oh, you know, love the site, we use it a lot in our game planning. And I was kind of blown away, because, you know, again, I don't really hear much from people about what I put out there. It's kind of like shouting into the ether. So, you know, that was kind of the first clue that, oh, wow, people actually are using this stuff. So, you know, it was kind of revelatory for me. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, I like a lot of people follow the Twitter account. It's been cool to see that growth over time. And but yeah, I mean, by and large, it's mostly just me shouting into the ether and thinking, well, I know people are listening, sort of, but like, I don't get much feedback.
Well, that's actually a great transition into a little review of 2020. You're absolutely right. It was shaping up to be such a unique year. I enjoyed listening to a pod that you had with Kyle Devitt. I think it's his own publication, but obviously Kyle works with Inside Lacrosse a lot. And just your review of 2020, I think it was like, yeah, you guys did this around the fall or so forth. But kind of love, you know, you and I kind of have like this fun little Big Ten stuff. And your comment about like it could have shaped to be kind of a disastrous year for the Big Ten. I secretly, yeah, that's probably kind of happy that this is kind of cut short. But yeah, just like looking back at 2020, you do see any like trends that you started to see? I know with the shot clock, you know, becoming more embedded into the game, like, things have changed from when you were first starting with lacrosse references. I didn't know if like besides that or any other things that you saw like starting to appear in 2020 that maybe you wished to have played out throughout the year.
Yeah. I mean, I think like Penn State, there's two things, right? And we'll get to that Big Ten stuff, because I just think it's fascinating. But like the other one was, you know, I remember we kind of got robbed of the last half of, you know, Grant Amen's career. But like, I remember the shot clock and after they first introduced it, it was very interesting to see, you know, cause I doing the play by play the way I do it, like it breaks down when a shot came in the shot clock. And so like, you could see that there were some huge differences. Most teams, as the shot clock kind of wound down, you know, it was like, let's just get a shot off no matter what kind of shot it is. So like shooting percentages tend to go down kind of precipitously at the end of the shot clock. But like Penn State was one team that you didn't really see that happen. You know, they were somehow able to generate good opportunities even late in the shot clock. And so, you know, seeing year two of that kind of data in relative to Grant Amend and O'Keefe and the Penn State offense, that was one thing that was kind of a bummer, just because like they were such an outlier when it came to ability to create good chances late in the shot clock. And so, I think that's, but, in general, I think there's a lot of that, right? We didn't get to see Sowers take Princeton to the tournament. We didn't get to see that last chance for Penn State to do what they did. So, I think those things are definitely the ones that stand out. From sort of a statistical perspective, but the Big Ten stuff was so fascinating. I mean, I live in North Carolina. And so Quentin and Anish and those guys, when they come down, a lot of times they eat at a certain restaurant in Durham. And I made a, well, I guess it was a one-sided bet. There was nothing at stake for me, but I tweeted to Anish. I was like, because he said something about Big East and Big Ten and tournament slots. And, that was the thing that I was most interested in. I said, okay, look, if the Big East gets more teams in the tournament, you got to let me come with you when you guys go for your chicken and waffles before a Duke game. selfishly and personally, we never got to resolve the bet, obviously. And because, obviously the season didn't get finished, but that last year with Georgetown and Providence had some good wins, and Villanova had a win over Maryland. Denver was, arguably the fourth best team in the Big East. And then in the Big Ten, right? I mean, Hopkins was having kind of an especially down year, and Michigan was Michigan, and Ohio State had a loss that put them squarely on the bubble. I mean, it was very conceivable that the Big East was going to get three teams in, and the Big Ten was just going to have Maryland and Penn State. It's there's not all those many opportunities to have, that was a bit of an out on a limb observation about the Big East and the Big Ten. But when I was running the simulations and looking at the number of tournament slots by conference, I mean, it was very close, and it was very plausible that the Big Ten could get, or Big East could get three. So it's a bit of a bummer to not see that get resolved. And Georgetown and that Carolina game got canceled. We were finally going to get to see, Georgetown up against an elite opponent. So I think those sorts of interconference things and the longer term trends that, we really didn't get to see how they played out. That was probably the most disappointing thing for me last year.
No, I agree, especially that Georgetown North Carolina game, because things carried over to this year. Georgetown has been so dominant. We talked about that in our 2021 section, but that opportunity to see them play against North Carolina was having a phenomenal year, which obviously carried over to 2021. Yep. All caveats aside, there were a lot worse things that happened because of COVID, but for the lacrosse fans out there, that was going to be a real treat to see. I found that the Ivy as well, I kind of wanted to see that. Obviously the Sour story is great, but the reemerging and that Cornell Penn State game, that essentially the coda to the season was just phenomenal. And you're totally right. We really missed out on what could have been a really delightful year with amazing performances. Looking at 2021, just before we get into other stuff, any just initial thoughts of, rankings or anything, or just teams of what you've seen so far in the first, few weeks of the season?
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough in the first couple games, right? Because you I feel like you need that rubber match. You have a team play two games, and you're like, with a third data point, you really get a sense of were they the team from the first game or the team from the second game, And I think take Syracuse, right? I mean, that was you have those two data points now of Army and Virginia, and it's they're probably not the best team ever. Like they looked against Virginia, they're probably not a four and eight team like they looked against Army. But without that third data point, it's just so hard to really kind of feel comfortable with anything. And, three and four games, I think, is when you start to get a sense of really what you're talking about. And it's tougher this year, obviously, because you don't have as many of those interconference games that kind of help you set some context. But I'm kind of reserving too much judgment on early trends until I have a little more data. But I will say, there's some teams and you kind of have a sense Rutgers, the improvement there is, obviously it's only two games, but because of the transfer situation, I feel much more confident saying they are a much better team than last year because you know, they it's not, you can't argue that they didn't improve because of the players they brought in. And it's not just Kirst, but like DeGenio at the faceoff. I mean, that was arguably a bigger improvement for them than bringing Kirst in. And I mean, he's been amazing. So like, you know, there's not too many things you can really take away after just a couple of games, but like, I think Rutgers is definitely one.
Absolutely. I think your point about Penn State, like they obviously, Grant Amend, so one of a kind player, friend of the pod, love Grant, and Penn State that year and the 2019 year, which is just remarkable. But the Rutgers style, like, you know, they definitely have no problem taking shots early in the shot clock. And maybe there's something with the numbers. Like if they are confident, your offense eventually getting points, you're can occasionally let turnovers or bad shots slide, because you just keep pushing the pace. Few teams, as we've seen this year, are really keeping up with them. That Ohio State game was kind of pretty remarkable, just because the way Ohio State played the week prior against Hopkins, yep. I thought it'd be a much more challenging game, and it just seemed like Rutgers was just like you're on a treadmill with somebody else, and they're at like 10, and you're trying to get there at 6.5 or 7, and the person's barely sweating. They seem totally in control.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Rutgers thing to me, like, and I think this goes back to just the idea of like how important possessions are. And I think, possessions sometimes get confused with time of possession, which is to me irrelevant, but like possessions is enormous. And you think about, and this may be part of the reason why they've been playing so aggressively, like they have a lot more confidence they're going to get the ball back, right? Because they had DeGenio transfer from St. John's, and like their face-off rank this year is, what are they, like they're 14th, right? And sort of when you look at that opponent adjusted face-off win rate, mm-hmm. and last year they were like what, 71st? So like, when you go from having, I think I put this in like, there last year they were on average minus 3 possessions a game, right? So they were not terrible, but like on a per game average, minus 3 is not very good, right? This year they're plus 5, right? So that shift from having an extra 8 possessions a game compared to their opponent, I mean, is enormous. And so when you have better sense you're going to get the ball back, I think you do kind of have that aggressiveness. I mean, if you think about 8 possessions, right, if you take an average efficiency of like, let's just say 30%, I mean, a difference of 8 possessions over the course of a game is like 2.5 goals. So like, yeah. Rutgers was spotting teams a goal last year, and now they're up a goal and a half just based on that face-off improvement. So, obviously the offense is better with Kirst, but like, it's not like their offense was bad last year. And that's the area they've improved the least, even though they are better. But like, you think about the face-offs and the saves and all that. I mean, they're much better across the board. And I honestly think the possession aspect from the face-offs is their biggest improvement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just think back to that Loyola game that lost by 1, and also lost by Stony Brook. But that Loyola game last year was endemic of that problem. I think they lost 23 of 24 face-offs, or 24 of 25. They literally only won one face-off this entire game. So, yeah, yep. It's...
You look at Notre Dame. Notre Dame's going to be in the same boat. I mean, they upgrade a lot at the face-off, bringing in Gallagher. And, I just think it's the kind of thing it's an underrated thing, but like when you have a possession advantage from the face-offs, you just have a lot more optionality in how you play the game. And versus like a team that's consistently losing face-offs, you have very little margin for error. And so, I think if we see a big improvement from Notre Dame this year, I think it's very plausible that it's going to flow from having a possession advantage from where they've traditionally had a possession deficit.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just from your site, seeing North Carolina number 1 in adjusted faceoff, and you just kind of see it on the field, even the close games that they had, the High Point game and the Richmond game, they still, just dominating and faceoff, and they had maybe not as efficient game. Right. Scoring-wise, but they're still putting up 60-plus shots, something that's like almost a third or a half more than some teams put up in an entire game.
Right, so, yeah. And the Heels have 50 more possessions than their opponents this year. Like, what are you supposed to do with that,
Oh, absolutely, and you're right. That's why they're overwhelming. They have the ball often, either they have an aggressive ride or just – their ability to transition quickly just always feels like teams are on their back foot when they're playing them. And I think that's the style this year. Like, you know, with the shot clock just totally changed the game. Like, yeah. Now it really is. You just got to keep scoring. Just like Carolina has been doing, like, this has been so impressive. But like, I think that's kind of what teams are going to have to do this year. Any player in particular of a standout in your opinion? I mean, you know, on your site, always follow your posts and stuff like that on Twitter as well. But Ryan Tierney seems to be, you know, kind of numbers wise, really having a standout season.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's wild. But it's funny, though. I mean, like, yeah, a standout season for sure. I mean, he's got the highest like EGA per game average so far of anybody. But the crazy thing is he's like he had 9 goals in his last game and 8 goals in his first game. And mm-hmm. and then in his second game, he shot 7% and scored 2 points against Sacred Heart. So it's like I find that fascinating that you have like just such a just a bonkers like V shape for him. And so, you know, it's like whoever plays Hofstra next is like, give me that Sacred Heart film so I can figure out what the heck they did to like, I don't know, maybe they had like a snowstorm. I don't know what was going on in that game, but like, it's just so, it's so strange. Like, I got to go back and look, but like, I can't imagine there's been anybody who's got like 2 10-point games sandwiched around a 2-point game, you know?
Definitely. Tierney, obviously, Gray as well, that. One of my favorite players to have an amazing season. Team-wise, you know, as a site, we've been big on Georgetown, and we love when the numbers back us. And your adjusted defensive ranking for Georgetown, literally in the negative, not a typo, because of their just dominating performance in their first two games.
Yeah.
You know, what have you seen from like Georgetown, you know, aside from the numbers, if you've been able to catch any of their games?
But like, I mean, watching McElroy has been one of the things that's been really impressive. I mean, like, because it, you know, you can think about defensive performance, right? It's two things, right? It's is your defense allowing like the guys on the field, right? Not the goalie. Are they allowing good shots? You know, versus like, is the keeper stopping them? Because you could have a great defensive unit, great slides, great communication, and if your goalie's just not up to the task, you know, your defensive efficiency might not look great. And so, you know, I think McElroy has been the one that really stands out this year. Like, so like, I think as good as Georgetown's defense has been, like splitting it out between like how good their unit on the field and how good McElroy has been is like, I mean, he's got like 6.5 excess saves so far. Right. So compared to just some normal league average goalie, he's stopped 6.5 goals. So like, if you think if they just had anybody back there, instead of giving up 2 goals, they would have given up 9 so far. And, you know, which the crazy thing is their defense has still been amazing. Cause like, if they gave up 9 goals over 2 games against Big East teams, you'd still be saying like how good they are. So, you know, it's been interesting to see, like, for them, it's been both not giving up good shots. And when they do give up a shot, like, he's been saving a lot more than you would expect anybody else to. So I mean, like, Mount St. Mary's, good luck, I guess.
Absolutely. No, it's just the you know, carrying over from last year and even prior, Georgetown's definitely really had something going. The Hopkins tournament game, they probably should have won that. They gave the all everything they could handle in 2019, and you know, they were starting out so dominant 2020 that it's good to see them, you know, continue on in 2021. Sometimes we talk and I see some of your tweets about like strength of schedule and stuff like that. Like, I again, this is just kind of eye test. Like, I know Georgetown hasn't been playing ACC or Big Ten opponents, but like, just the way they've just been dismantling teams, I don't see like some people like disregard it just because, like, you know, they haven't played Duke or, you know, Maryland, and, you know, that will hopefully come in the tournament. But like, even strength of schedule arguments aside, like, it's still pretty dominant performance, right? Or it's not just the teams that they're playing.
Yeah,
I don't want to put words in your mouth or anything, but I would just love your take on that, because
I think there's definitely an element there that's like the numbers say they are very good, but like I'm not somebody who says like oh, I would guarantee you they're going to beat, you know, XYZ team because of what the numbers say. I mean, I think there's an element of truth to, like, until you really prove it on the field, you know, what guarantee do we have that they really can run with North Carolina or Duke? I mean, so, like, I am sort of on the side of, like, prove it with playing somebody, by playing one of those teams, right? And I think you certainly could make an argument that, like, why didn't they schedule some of those teams? Or, like, everybody else is picking up great opponents left and right out of nowhere. Like, why wouldn't they go play Army? You know, so I'd love to see them do that and really prove it on the field. I mean, look, the numbers do suggest that they could do it, right? The lax ELO, the ELO model that I have for team strength, I mean, they're the number three team in the country. And traditionally, you know, the ELO model, if it says that you're going to beat a team 60% of the time, then 60% of the time you do beat that team. So, like, you know, if you think about, let's see, who's, I'm just pulling up, like, who's, whose number, I think 1 and 2 is, like, Duke and still Yale right now. But, like, yeah, Georgetown's 3. So, like, you know, the ELO model says that if they played Maryland, they would, on a neutral field, they would beat them, you know, 52, 53% of the time. So, like, you know, I don't want to discount it and say, like, I'm not totally in the camp of, like, they're terrible until they prove otherwise. Like, I think they're very good. And I think if they played Maryland on a neutral field, they'd probably win half the games. But, like, I don't fault people for saying, like, I want to see them play a top opponent before I'll really believe kind of what the numbers are saying. Like, so, like, I guess I put it that way. If, like, if you wanted to give me 100 bets that Georgetown would beat Maryland, and, you know, you thought it was going to be 25% of the time, I would take those 100 bets because, like, over the course of 100 games, they'd probably win half of them. But, like, you know, again, I don't fault people for wanting to see them prove it on the field. And, you know, I think if we could get more great games between great teams, like, that's a good thing. So, like, let's keep the pressure on Georgetown to go find a game like some, like, you know, an Army or find a way to play Maryland or something like that.
Oh, no, absolutely. And no way if I hope I didn't imply or infer you did or anybody else doesn't have them in the top four, like a totally reasonable argument. I just felt like I'm just impressed as a take, like, you know, they just keep winning and they're doing so in such a way, just dismantling teams. St. John's. I mean, St. John's is, again, not Duke, North Carolina, but they put up points against Hofstra, and Hofstra was a point. And just the fact that they held them to one goal, really just stood out.
I think a lot of the time the argument of, like, oh, I want to see them do it on the field, what people really mean when they say that is, like, I don't think they're very good, right? And, you know, because otherwise you wouldn't be saying you want to preview, you say they're good. So I think that's where I kind of fall in between there, right? Like, I think they are a very, very good team. I think if they played Maryland, they'd win, you know, 50 out of 100 games. I think I'm more on the side of, like, Georgetown is very, very good. And I think if you're saying, like, I want to see them proven on the field, and what you're really saying is, I don't think they're very good because they've been winning a bunch of Big East games. Like, I think the fact that they're winning these Big East games by the margin they are and the dominance that they showed last year, I don't think you can discount that. I think it's very valid. I think, you know, you know, Lax ELO uses every game played, right? It doesn't matter who you played against. It's a model that's designed to take into account those, like, non-elite opponents and calibrate a team's strength according to that. And, you know, it says they're the number three team in the country. And I certainly don't have a good reason to argue otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. That's actually a fantastic transition to talk to you about scheduling. Like, you know, this year is just so unique, obviously, because of COVID precautions, and every team's doing everything they should do in a reasonable way, and we totally commend them. But, you know, one of the unfortunate things is we don't get some of these non-conference games that we're kind of used to early in the season. Just wanted to get your thoughts, like, you know, how do you think, like, some of these different scheduling patterns are going to impact, like, you know, kind of the at-large race. I think Jake shared with me a conversation in our DMs where we said that I thought, like, the conference-only schedule may kind of benefit the Big Ten, but you had a great take that there's also a chance it could negatively impact them, similar to what happened in 2020. Like, if the middle-tier teams aren't that great and the bottom tier is bad, and then, like, the top-tier team, like, has an unexpected loss, it could really impact the at-large race. So sorry to make a but preamble. I just love your thoughts on like just how the scheduling may impact the you know, the at-large race when for Selection Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a lot on what the committee does and if they announce anything. But like, I mean, I think the argument has been made many times that like RPI for the Big Ten is irrelevant this year, because like every, you know, RPI is three factors, right? It's your win percentage, it's your opponent's win percentage, and it's your opponent's win percentage. And if you only play a Big Ten schedule, then those last two factors, which are 75% of your total, are going to be, you know, 0.5, right? Everybody's going to have the same record, same scores in those two factors. So like an at-large team with, you know, at best, probably a you know, an RPI value of like, you know, 0.53, because that's about the best you can do if you're a bubble team and you're in the Big Ten, you know, that isn't going to cut it. That's nowhere near the bubble if you're just looking at RPI in most seasons. So, you know, I think it depends, right? Like, I don't think the selection committee is going to be like, we are using RPI as our primary calculation, because, you know, they're going to understand that RPI is basically, you know, severely undercounting a Big Ten bubble team. So, you know, I don't honestly know that the schedules are going to impact who gets in at large all that much. I just think that they're going to have to go away from some of the numerical sort of ranking that they've used, especially RPI in the past, to do it. Now, will they announce that and say, we're scrapping RPI and we're just going to go with our guts and look at watch film? I mean, that would be totally fine. I'd have no problem with that. The worst thing they can do is just say, we're going to use RPI and like the Big Ten champ gets in and nobody else does from that conference, because that may not be appropriate. I mean, the last thing we want is clearly top teams in Maryland and Rutgers who are playing in the Big Ten title game and the loser doesn't get an NCAA bid. That would be not good.
The meltdown in Trenton, New Jersey will be we talked about for decades. If that happened, definitely a worst case scenario. But no, the perfect part of the conversation is like, what would the committee, what would you do? Like, if make a suggestion, hit you up, Zach, you know, A, we love the site, but B, you know, we just want to get your thoughts of like, you know, how to make this tournament. Like, what would you look for besides the eye test, which, you know, we jokingly in our DMs said that this is the year of the eye test, but any suggestions or just thoughts, you know, you don't have to put it that frame.
I mean, I think it's, you know, strength of record to me is a stat that I've always kind of relied on for selection purposes, right? Strength of record is, you don't, it's going to solve a lot of those problems, because RPI doesn't care how good a team is, right? It only cares about what happened on the field and who you played, right? So it's like 75% strength of schedule and 75% win or 25% win percentage. But like strength of record is kind of a cool stat, because it, you know, it takes the pregame strength of the teams and says like, okay, if you knock off a number one team, you get like a lot more points for that. If you beat a nobody, you don't get much credit. And in a year like this, like, I think that can make a difference in the Big Ten, right? If you have, you know, let's say you have two losses, but one of your wins was Maryland and your two losses were, you know, Rutgers and Maryland, right? If you're Ohio State, maybe that's what you end up with, right? I think strength of record could be a useful way to say, look, we know that RPI is irrelevant. Strength of record kind of implicitly values strength of schedule, and it very much values like wins on the field. So like if they were to ask me, we need a numeric system to use in place of RPI, I think it would probably be that. But the challenge, one of the other problems with that is like strength of record doesn't work as well when teams have very different number of games played. So like UMass, right? Like they haven't been able to get on the field yet. And like, who knows how many games they're going to play. Their strength of record is probably going to be suboptimal because they're just not going to have many chances to rack up quality wins. So like, all that is to say, I don't know that there's a great numerical system to use this year. Like, I think it would be cool if they said, we're going to look at some different numbers rather than just RPI, like they normally do, to inform our decision. But like, I think if I were them, I'd be like, oh no, you don't want a statistical system this year. This year is too weird. Just like watch film and pick the best 16 teams or however they're going to do it. So I not to say I would totally demur, but like, yeah, I don't know how confident I would be in any sort of numeric system this year. It's just such a strange season.
Oh, absolutely. And it really is apples and oranges, you know, if the other team has a healthy non-conference schedule. I commend the ACC for being able to put some pretty challenging out-of-conference games on the slate. But, you know, mm-hmm. There's a good side of that, you know, but UVA takes care of Army, and then, you know, on the flip side, Army really took it to Syracuse. So, but it's just good to see, like, them at least attempting that. But, yeah, you're right. It's going to be kind of difficult when Selection Sunday rolls about. Always a favorite part of our show. I'd love to kind of put our guest on the spot. So, Final Four picks, comfortable enough to share that with the audience? I know we don't have too much out there, but we won't hold you too much. If you enjoyed this, we'll come back again in April, and we can always revise. But
If I'm right, we'll come back and talk about how right. If I'm wrong, we'll say it was early.
We'll memory hold this portion if it's that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, there's sort of two tiers, right? Like, if I had to, if you said you have to give me four and you have no choice, give me four teams, that's it. I'd go Duke, Carolina, Maryland, and Georgetown. So, like, when I ran the last set of simulations from the games over the weekend, those were the teams that had the four best strength of record ratings, right? So, like, without much other proxy to go off of, like, I'll go with those four. I mean, I think it's a reasonable choice, and I think the strength of record suggests that they're going to have the four best resumes. And, you know, I think those are the four that I'd probably say, like, if you let me go a little bit wider, right? I mean, I think there's a couple other teams, and I was a little surprised to see this, but like the next four teams when I ran the simulation were Virginia, Denver, Rutgers, and Loyola, which, like, I mean, you can craft a story around Denver, right? I mean, they have a huge team. They'll figure out an offense that works. They might end up with TD Ireland. So, like, I could see them. Virginia, you know, like, who knows? Rutgers, there's a reason for them. Loyola was a bit surprising, but, like, you know, probably going to run through the Patriot League again. Maybe a speed bump with Army, but, like, I could see them. So, I mean, those are the eight teams that, like, the simulation says have a good shot to get there. I think if you force me into four, I'd go with the Heels and Duke and Maryland and Georgetown.
Listen, anytime a person of your heft agrees with my Final Four picks, exactly, I'll wholeheartedly support. So I agree. Yeah, I was going to say, I like how you widened the window. I was going to say if you had, like, even one or make a second team by the dark horse, yeah. But I guess maybe those would be your four, or is there a team outside that four that the Irish, they are my dark horse on our preseason picks. I thought they were going to have a much better ACC season with all those transfers. I don't know if you had a dark horse besides those four that you mentioned earlier.
And that's a tough thing. Like, with one game, like, the data, the models haven't really caught up with them too much, because a lot of my stuff moves fairly slowly, right? It doesn't jump around too much, right? So one great game from Notre Dame against Robert Morris isn't going to push them into the top echelon. But, like, you know, the algorithm doesn't know that, you know, Kyle Gallagher and all those guys are on Notre Dame now. So, like, I could easily see that. I mean, like, you know, there's no reason that a team like Syracuse or Notre Dame, Army, I mean, even Penn State, UMass, I mean, all those teams are, like, if you told me that we're here sitting here on Memorial Day and one of those teams is in the Final Four, say, oh, okay, yeah, I mean, I could buy that. So, yeah, I mean, I think any of those teams, and especially a team that has had a bunch of transfers and looks very different than they did last year, is going to be sitting there in the conversation, just because, like, you know, assuming they're able to gel and assuming they're able to make the most of those new skill sets, I mean, they could easily be a top four team. And I mean, I think this year more than many, you really do need to wait until you see what a team looks like in late April, because it's going to take a while to gel. As you know, you saw that with Duke, right? Their last two games were much better than their first two games from an offensive perspective, as they've kind of figured out how all the pieces fit together. So, yeah, I mean, I think any of those teams would be there. And a year like this, if I don't think there's any team that would really be a huge surprise.
I agree. Like, I think we, it's time. We'll see, probably surprise. That's, every season has great surprises and teams that it's falter. I was like, you know what? It pained me, the meme of the guy like grabbing his heart when you rightfully, right. This is harsh, but fair. Rightfully, the joke that on Twitter about like Rutgers, also be number one. I think it was Chris or Jake had made a point about like them making the tournament, and then you rightfully were like, yeah, but probably a lot of people thought. I think that was the 2017 year, 2018, but off the top of my head, but I remember that vividly. Yeah. So, you're right. You're like, even being number one in the season. Yeah, Hofstra caught that at one point in time. They're having a pretty good start to the season, but they're number one and found the CAA and ended up not making the tournament. So there's nothing guaranteed in life or lacrosse. So
and that wasn't even an injury situation. Like, it's like there's many reasons. It's like anybody that has too strong of a conviction after two games is liable to be liable to look foolish.
Absolutely, pride goes before the fall. So that's why we're always a big fan of the reasonable conversations like this, and having to defend your takes. Zach, I can't thank you enough. I hope everyone listening enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed talking to you. If you are interested in following Lacrosse Reference on Twitter, if you want to share your handle.
Yeah, it's Lax Reference. So Lacrosse Reference is too long, so we had to shorten it to Lax Reference.
Listen, the characters matter. It's smart. It's needed. This Justin Timberlake said in Social Network. And I, again, can't recommend the Lacrosse Reference site enough. There's a great open source portion. And if you're so inclined, I also recommend the Lacrosse Reference Pro portion. Zach does great work, and his teammates who helped the site. Just want to commend everybody and compliment all the great work you guys do.
Well, I appreciate it.
Everyone, we should get this episode up hopefully Tuesday night or Wednesday. But again, Zach, thanks so much. And, we'll hopefully, do this again shortly. Be great to have more data and continue this conversation.
Absolutely. I'd love it.
All right. Take care, everyone.
All right. Take care.